start with the very second pasuk, Shlach Lecha Anoshim. So we're going to say three things about this, two short things and then a longer overview of the whole Chet HaMeraglim, what exactly the sin of the spies was. First of all, there's an interesting Kliyoker. The Kliyoker says, Shlach Lecha Anoshim, that Lecha means, can mean for your sake. Lecha, like Lech Lecha, for your sake. So he says, I don't think he says this is the real pshat in the pasuk, but he says a cute idea. He says to Moshe Rabbeinu, for your sake, send men. Because the men are going to sin. They're going to have to stay 40 years in the desert, and you extend your life 40 years because you're not allowed to go to Eretz Yisrael. But if you send women, they won't sin. We'll go into Eretz Yisrael right away, and you'll end up having to die sooner. So for your sake, better to send men. Okay, that was for the women. The Sfarno says something, Shlach Lecha Anoshim. Sfarno says like this, that the Rabbanu Shem told Moshe Rabbeinu, if you're sending spies already, you pick the spies. You send them. Don't let the people pick the spies. Why? Because you'll send great people. And even if they sin, it'll be salvageable. But if the people pick the spies, they're not going to pick necessarily great people, and then the situation will be unsalvageable. And the Sfarno explains what he means. L'chora Moshe Rabbeinu sent great people. They all came back. They were greatly wicked, and they caused disaster. What could have been worse? Says the Sfarno like this, the way I understand it. Great people came back and said the truth, partially. They said that it's a good land. Rabbanu Shel Olam described it honestly to us. It's an Eretz Zavas Chol of Tzavas, very good land. However, our perspective or our perspective is that it's impossible to conquer. We can't conquer it. Therefore, Moshe Rabbeinu didn't have to say, you're liars. If they came back and said it was a bad land, and the Rabbanu Shem told us a lie, how could Moshe Rabbeinu counter that? Right? They saw it. He didn't see it. So what could he say? Trust God? Right? He's telling you the truth? These people saw it, and they said it's a terrible land. So he would have had to totally go against and change over what the spies said, and they would have raised doubts in the people's mind whether in fact God told them the truth or not. But the spies came back and they said, yes, it's a good land. The only thing is, we don't think we can conquer it. That almost Rabbeinu had to do is give them chizuk and tell them that their perspective is wrong, their assessment of the situation is wrong, and you could conquer it, and the Rabbanu Shem will help you. But it wasn't a matter of denying or arguing with them over facts. Is it a good land? Is it not a good land? Okay. However, had they sent not great people, they would have come back and said the land's not a good land. And then Moshe Rabbeinu had nothing to say. What could he say? It is a good land. I didn't see it. They coming back with a report that it's not a good land, that God lied to them. That would have been much more difficult to counteract. Now let me tell you what you can learn from this Sfarno. The difference between a great person and a small person. Why would the, if it weren't great people, and these were great people who were greatly wicked. So what difference does it make if you're a great person or a small person? Right? They both are Rishai. The difference, I think, is like this. Great people can see things in many colors, and in detail. And small people, right, can only see black and white. Either it's good or it's bad. If it appears bad to them, everything's bad. If it appears good, everything's good. A greater person can be discerning. Right? He doesn't lose the trees because of the forest. And a small person doesn't see the trees because of the forest. Right? It's either one way or the other way. So somebody who's negative, a negative person, who's a small person, everything is negative. He can't see anything positive about the things he sees negative, and he can't see anything negative about the things he sees positive. It's either black or white. A greater person can be discerning. And yes, they came back and they had a negative feeling about conquering Eretz Israel, but that didn't influence them to see it totally bad. They could see the good too.
So they... Small people saw it great.
Yeah, but they also wouldn't have come back like that. If these people didn't, we'll see in one second what the sin was, and we'll see that the smaller people would have had the sin also, and they would have compounded it by coming back and saying the land's no good either. Which they didn't do. They said, it's true, the Rabbanu Shlom described the land properly. It's Eretz Zov Haschol V'Dvash. We can't argue with that. But our perception is that we can't survive there. Okay. What was the sin of the spies? So, let's first see, there's quite a few questions here. The Rabbanu Shlom tells Moshe Rabbeinu, Shlach lecho anoshim. You said, I'm not telling you to send, I don't think it's a good idea, seemingly. The Rabbanu Shlom said, I'm not going to tell you to send these spies, but if you want to do it, do it. Now, if you heard that from the Rabbanu Shalom, the Chorah, you would see, it's not God's will to send spies, I'm not going to send them. Moshe Rabbeinu sends them anyway. Secondly, did Moshe Rabbeinu know that there was a problem? Maybe he didn't realize there was a problem. Then why did he daven for Yoshua, call Yoshiach miatzas meraglim? God should save you from the plot of the meraglim. He knew it was a plot, and he sent them anyway. Did he know there was a plot? And if there was a plot, then these people obviously were not tzaddikim. Yet it says, kulam anoshim ba'oso shot tzaddikim hoy. At that moment, they were tzaddikim. So, obviously, there was no plot. Because there was a plot, they weren't tzaddikim. And then, Rashi contradicts himself. Because it says, when they came back, vayelchu vayovo, they went and they came back. Makish aviyosam, aviyosam lehalichosam. Just like when they came back, they were shoyim, when they left, they were shoyim. So which is it? Here it says they were all tzaddikim. Here it says they were shoyim when they left. Here Moshe Rabbeinu sends them, and yet he davens for Yeshua, God should save you from the plot of the Meraglim. There seemed to have been a plot already. Another question. It says that when they went, Moshe Rabbeinu told them, Vishchazaktem ulakachtem prihoritz. Moshe commanded them to bring back fruit. The Midrashim say the following. Only 10 of them brought back fruit. Okay? 8 of them carried the cluster of grapes, one took a pomegranate, and one took a fig. 2 didn't take. So the Medrash says, who didn't take? Kalev and Yoshua. Because they were not Ba'oso Eitza. They were not part of the plot. That means taking the fruit was part of the plot. Right? Seemingly, they came back and they said, the fruit is unusual, so to the people if they're unusual, and for usual people, you can't survive there. So it was part of the plot to bring back the fruit. There's only one problem. Moshe Rabbeinu told them to bring back the fruit. Secondly, there's another medrash that seems to contradict his first medrash completely. The medrash says, only, what's it called, that Kalev and Yoshua took out their swords, and they told the other 10, either you take the fruit, or we're going to kill you, or you're going to kill us. They didn't want to take the fruit. And Kalev and Yoshua forced them to take the fruit. Now, if taking the fruit was part of the plot, and that's why Yoshua and Kalev didn't take it, why did they force the other ones to take it? Manavshah. You could say that the Midrashim argue on each other. But coupled with that, the Moshe told them to bring the fruit, how could that be part of the plot? So, what's going on here? So, I want to explain that there's many ways to explain this. But I'm going to tell you the way that I understand it, and everything fits in very nicely. That's the following. Let's give you some background first, and then we'll apply it to what went on over here. There are different kinds of relationships that HaKadosh Baruch Hu has with Klal Yisrael, with the world in general, how he exercises his divine providence in the world. In the desert, right, the divine providence was called Hashgacha Nisis, miraculous Hashgacha. Meaning everything was open. Everything happened with a miracle. They had to eat. Man came from the heavens. They had a drink, a be'er followed them in the desert. People sinned immediately. What's it called? They got burned up by fire that came out of the heavens. Or snakes came, or whatever. The punishment was immediate and obvious. What the sin was, what the punishment was, everything was open and miraculous. Not natural, supernatural. That's the way the Rabbanu Shalom dealt with Klal Yisrael and the Midbar. For various reasons, when they would come to Eretz Yisrael, they knew that that was going to change. And that would no longer be God's relationship with them. They knew that Moshe Rabbeinu warded this off. God wanted to start this new relationship already in the desert through angels. Angels meaning through nature. And not to have that relationship with them totally miraculously for various reasons, because it wasn't to their betterment either sometimes, but to some degree it was. So Moshe Rabbeinu davened that the Rabbanu Shalom should not change that hashgacha in the desert. But when Yeshua took over, a malach came and said, Atabasi, I'm here now. Meaning that when the Rabbanu Shalom said, from now on I'm sending a malach to be between us, and my hashgacha is going to go through malachim, it started in the time of Yeshua. And that meant that things from then on would be basically natural. You weren't going to get mon anymore. You'd have to plow and plant and harvest your wheat and make bread. And that's the way you would eat. Rain would give you water and so on. It still, however, was a second relationship. That's called Nisim B'Derech HaTeva. Miraculous, right? Hashgacha that is, but it's natural means, but still miracles, hidden miracles. How so? Because it would be clear the relationship between mitzvahs and Torah and nature. In other words, it would rain if you kept mitzvahs. If it didn't keep mitzvahs, it wouldn't rain. So it was obvious that there was a correlation between keeping mitzvahs and rain. The weatherman would announce, not that there's a cold front coming from the east, right, high pressure system, and therefore we predict rain within the next 3 days. He would say, we've made a survey, and 95% of the Jewish people are keeping mitzvahs, therefore we predict rain in the next 3 days. Now, that's a miracle. But it's a natural miracle. It's not a be'er, it's rain. So, B'chukosai Teilechu describes that kind of situation. The Ramban calls that's called Hashgachas Nisim B'Derech HaTeva. It's miracles, because there's a direct correlation between Avodas Hashem and nature, but it's hidden miracles. Then there's another kind of hashgacha which we're familiar with. That's called Hester Ponim, where God hides his face. Where you don't see, everything happens naturally, and you don't see the correlation readily between mitzvahs and avodas Hashem and nature. It appears that things happen naturally, and that they are the result of haphazard economic, social, political causes, and or just happenstance or whatever, or coincidence. You don't see the correlation directly between God's hiding his face. Those are the three basic kinds of hashgacha. Says the Vilna Gaon that these three kinds of hashgacha are only different from our standpoint. They are not different at all from God's standpoint. It's not that sometimes God is controlling the world and sometimes he's not. He's always controlling the world. The same way that God was in control when there were open miracles is the same exact way that God's in control when, if you plant, plow, and harvest, you have a successful harvest because of mitzvahs. And it's the same control that God has when you plant, plow, and harvest and you don't see any correlation to mitzvahs. It's still God's doing. Except, what's the difference? The difference is how we see it. In one sense, we can see it openly. One, we see it more hidden. And one, we don't see it at all. It's all completely masked and hidden. It's only how it appears to us. But from God's standpoint, God never relinquishes his divine providence on the world. God is always in control, and he's always involved. He doesn't leave the world to coincidence, happenstance, or whatever, even when there's Hester upon him. Hester upon him does not mean that God pulls back. It just means he hides his face. You don't see it. He's behind the scenes, but he's there. It's not that he takes a vacation. The lashon itself implies that. Hester Ponim. He's just hiding his face. The people of the generation made a mistake. Their view was that if things are going to change and things are going to happen naturally, naturally it means that we're the ones in control. We're the ones who are making it happen. It's cause and effect, which the Michtam Eliyahu says is not true. There's no cause and effect, let's say earning a living, right? You do what you're supposed to do and you create your living. It's not true. You do what you're supposed to do is a prerequisite. It's a condition. You fulfill the condition, God gives you your living. But it's not a cause and effect relationship. You cause the living, and that's pretty clear, because if you think about it, right, person digs ditches. He gets paid $20 an hour for digging ditches, okay? At the end of the week, he expects his paycheck, a few hundred dollars. Okay, is there any correlation between digging the ditch and getting the money and getting the food? No. The person who says he's going to pay you may drop dead and not be able to pay you. The economy may fall and you may not be able to get paid. You may get the money and there may be no food. So there's no direct correlation, cause and effect between your digging ditches and your eating. And same thing with any other profession. You plant the seeds, you cultivate it, who says that it's going to grow? There may be a million factors that you're not in control of that may cause it that all your work is going to go to nothing. So you fulfill a condition. God wants you to work. He wants you to put your hishtadlus in. But whether you're going to be successful in the end is up to him. So the parnasa, and it's in everything. Refuah, the same thing. You go to the doctor, gives you medicine, gives you an operation. Two people can have the exact same thing, the exact same medication, exact same operation. One dies, one lives. The doctor's not in control. There are a million factors that no one can control that ultimately make the final effect. But you're not exempt from making the attempt. You have to put in the hishtadlus. For various reasons, I'm not going to go into them now. That's pretty clear, right? That nothing in this world do we cause the effect because of too many factors that are not in our hands. Just to proof that I always like to say of what's it called, that parnosa is not a cause and effect kind of thing, right? There are people who have done every right thing to guarantee that they'll be able to make a good living, right? Doctors, lawyers, engineers in Russia that got all the right degrees, all the expertise, and then all of a sudden they're out of Russia, in New York, in Israel, and there's no need for engineers, lawyers, or doctors, so they're cleaning people's offices. Right? They have all the right credentials, everything right. And they're scavenging around for food. So they did all the right hishtadlus and didn't work. And there are people who have all the wrong hishtadlus and they're successful. Right? Two examples I love to give are years ago in America. It was a guy who marketed a pet rock. Remember that? What he did was, he put a plain, ordinary rock. I mean, here we could be billionaires, right? In Matatiora, there's so many rocks. We once wanted Maccabean rocks to put on your cemetery plots. We wanted to put that out. It never worked. But this guy, what did he do? Took a rock, put it in a box that looked like a cage, right, a plain cardboard box, but he printed like a cage on the box. He had a one page of instructions how to take care of this pet rock. Didn't have to be fed, didn't have to be walked, didn't need water, didn't need sunlight, very cheap pet. Right? How to take care of your pet rock. Okay. And now, who in their right mind would buy a rock that they could go out and get a whole zoo full for free outside? It was nothing special. But that's Americans, right? He sold it for $10 and people bought pet rocks, okay? So if he would come to me, he wanted, you know, me to invest in this project. I was telling you, out of your mind, nobody in the world is going to buy a rock they can get for free just because you put it in a nice box with a list of instructions. But people bought it. He became a fan. He became a millionaire overnight. Another thing, Cabbage patch dolls. Right? Dolls that were so ugly that a mother couldn't love them. I know some kids who mamas look like those dolls. Now, who is going to buy their daughter an ugly doll? It doesn't make sense. It didn't have to make sense. It became a fad. And the guy became a millionaire. So, people can do all the right things and be starving, and can do things that have no shaykhis, and they're rich. They're supposed to get rich. They got rich. So, it's very hard to say it's a cause and effect situation. Right? Especially over long term. Short term, you may feel, do the right thing, you make money. But we know enough, especially these days, that it doesn't work like that long term. So, they, on the other hand, they thought that that's the case. Okay? They're great people. And again, thought doesn't mean they made the mistake. They could listen to my shir and everything would have been okay. But there's a very big difference between what you know, understand, and what you feel. And how you live it. Okay? We all know, right, that the Rabbanu Shalom controls the world or whatever, but we still think that our hishtadlus is what causes it. Deep down, right, that's how we function. Not because we don't believe. There's a difference between believing and really, really feeling it. And there's a very big gulf between the two. You can believe something and you really believe it, but it's not real to you. It's an idea. It's theory. You know, my father, Olav HaShalom, he says, tell the following joke. But you can see that, you know, believing is one thing, but acting upon it, you know, in real life is a different thing. So there's an atheist, fell off a cliff. He's hurtling to his death. And he figures, you know, it's worth a try. He never believed in a God, but, you know, maybe. So he looks up to heaven as he's falling towards the earth, and he says, if there's anybody up there, and you save me, I will be your faithful servant forever. And at that moment, a tree pushes through the cliff, and he gets stuck on the branch of the tree. Saved miraculously. It's obviously a miracle. He looks up and he says, thank you, God, I'm your faithful servant forever. He's hanging on the limb of the tree, 5 minutes, 10 minutes, 15 minutes, getting tired. So he looks up and he says, God, what do you want me to do? And a voice comes out of the heavens, let go of the branch. The guy thinks for a few seconds, looks back up, and he says, is there anybody else up there? Yeah, you know, I believe, but not to let off grow the branch. You know, there's a limit how much you believe. So there's a difference between really believing and really feeling it. These people believed 100%. And Moshe Rabbeinu could have told them a much better shear than I'm giving you. And convinced them. But he knew that they still would have a place that they didn't feel like that. The people, therefore, that was called Atzas Meraglim. Not that they had a plot to come back and malign Eretz Yisrael. That wasn't Atzas Meraglim. Atzas Meraglim means they had this idea that when they get to Eretz Yisrael, everything's going to happen naturally. They're going to be in control. And therefore, they came to Moshe and they said, we have to get ready. We're ready to go into Eretz Israel. We know the Hashgacha is going to change when we get there. And we're going to be the ones who are causing what's happening. So we're going to have to send spies. That's the way that you conquer a land by natural means. So we'd like to get started and send spies in order that we can get ready for this new kind of relationship with God where we're in control. Now, Moshe Rabbeinu goes to Rabbanu Shalom and he says, what should I do? God says, well, it's a little bit, I can't tell you to send spies. That's not, they want to prepare for the new kind of relationship. And the new kind of relationship, the people don't come to the leader and he goes and asks God what to do. That's miraculous. What happens in the new kind of relationship? They go to the leader and he decides on his own what he thinks the Ratzon Hashem is based on his knowledge of Torah or whatever. So I can't tell you if they want to get involved and work this out, fine. They want to start this new relationship, it's fine with me. But you can't have it both ways. I can't tell you to do it. You're going to have to make the decision on your own, because that's part of the process in a natural scenario. So shlach lecho, you want to send, because okay, I'm not telling you it's bad to send. I'm just telling you that it can't be that I'm going to tell you to send, and they're doing it because they want to do things in a natural way. So if once it's natural, then you have to do it the way it's going to be then. Okay. So Moshe Rabbeinu says, look, I could speak to them and try to convince them, but nothing's going to convince them more than actions, where they themselves come to the conclusion and see clearly that they're making a mistake, that they're not in control. that the Rebbeim Shem still in control. So therefore, he assumed that what would happen is the following. He was hoping what would happen is the following. He'd send these great people who had this mistake. They thought that, again, nature means we're in control to a certain degree, whatever on their level it meant. And they're going to go and see that there's no natural way that we can conquer Eretz Israel. And they're going to put the following facts together, and they're going to have to come to a conclusion. Fact one, God said we're going to conquer Eretz Israel. Fact two, God said it's going to happen in a natural way. Fact three, there is no way that we can affect that. Fact four, therefore, it must be that even if it's going to happen in a natural way, we don't have to affect it. God's going to affect it, and it'll look natural. That should have been their conclusion by witnessing all these factors. What was their conclusion? The opposite. God said we're going to conquer it. God said it's going to be natural. Natural means that we have to cause it. We can't cause it. Therefore, it can't happen. And that's what they said. Chazak hu minenu. The enemy is even stronger than God. Now, what, they were kindergarten children? They thought that these enemies with an atomic bomb could, right, whatever they had. What, spears? They could, what, stronger than God? So God can't, even God can't help us. Why? Because God tied his hands. Because God's will is it should happen naturally. That means he's relinquishing his control to us. And we can't do it. So therefore it can't happen. God promised us it's going to happen, but he said it's going to happen if we can do it. We can't do it. So God tied his hands. Therefore the enemy is stronger than God based on God's will that it's not going to happen miraculous anymore. It's going to happen by nature. And we are the ones who caused nature. That was, they renamed with that mistake. Now Moshe Rabbeinu told them the following. And therefore, the people were tzaddikim. They had a mistaken idea. That doesn't make you a Rasha. It means that you're a tzaddik, basically. Actions are what make you a tzaddik or a Rasha. But they had a mistaken hashkafa. Until it had some repercussion, it didn't make them Rishoyim. But once they went and they used that mistaken hashkafa to come back and make a bad report, then where was the source of that bad report? In their mistaken hashkafa to begin with. So even though in the beginning it didn't affect their being a tzaddik, but retroactively now comes out that their rishus came as a result of something that existed from the time that they left. Their bad understanding. Their bad hashkafa. Memela, Moshe Rabbeinu daven for Yoshua. Yoshua, you're going to have to be the leader in this time of natural relationship with God. Call Yoshiacha mi'atzas meraglim, or some midrashim say mi'atzas ador hazeh. God should save you from the plot, not the plot, from the atz, it means from the idea, the philosophy of this generation. They think that only in the desert where things happen miraculously is God in control. But if God's relinquishing that, he's making us in control. Now it's going to happen naturally. That was called Atzas Meraglim. It doesn't mean the plot to come back and malign Eretz Israel. It means the idea that was behind the sending of spies, which was the mistaken concept that generation believed in, which Moshe tried to uproot, but he wasn't successful. And it took 40 years in the desert for them to understand that idea. That's why Moshe says like this. What is the most blatant contradiction to this philosophy? That nature means we're in control. Okay, the blatant contradiction to that is rain, is food, vegetation. Because there's no way in the world that a human being can control the outcome of vegetation, a fruit. Because it depends on rain, and rain is one thing that even naturally we can't produce. It's a key that's in the hands of the Rebbeim Shalom. So therefore Moshe said like this, if you don't have this problem, and you believe that God's in control, I don't want you to come face to face with the fruit, because the fruit is a big nesoyin, because it makes it clear that you're not in control. And that could really put a person off over the brink if he thinks that he's supposed to be in control and he can't control things. Then if you think you're supposed to be in control and you can't control, you get tremendously depressed and you can't function. But if you believe that I'm not supposed to be in control, God's in control, then this doesn't bother me that much. So he says like this. If the hischazakten, if you need to be strengthened, you still are not convinced that nature means God's still in control, but it looks natural, and all you have to do is fulfill a condition, but not be the cause of the effect, then stay away from the fruit, because the fruit could push you over the brink. But if you're not convinced, and you need that chizik, then come face to face with the fruit, because it can't do any harm. At best, it'll convince you the right way. At worst, it'll just make things worse, but you're anyway believe that you're in control. So if you need that chizik, then come face to face with the fruit. Because the fruit can either make it or break it. So if you don't need that chizik, better to leave it alone. Don't put yourself in that intense kind of nisayon. But if you need the chizik, it's better this than nothing. Right? You know what it can be compared to? It says that you're not allowed to make cheshbonos of when Mashiach's going to come. Because it could put people, you made a mistake, and it doesn't come in the time that was predicted, people will give up hope, and that we've been known, the people who thought Mashiach was coming at a certain time, and it didn't come, they went off the derech completely. They converted to Christianity or Islam or whatever in certain situations. So therefore the rabbis prohibited calculating when Mashiach's going to come. However, there were gedolim who did make calculations. And the idea they said is the following. They did it in a generation when people anyway were giving up hope. And giving them something to hang on to wouldn't make things worse, could only make it better. If they didn't do anything, they would have given up because of despair. This at least could make things better. It can't make it any worse. But in a normal situation, you don't put yourself into such a situation. Same thing over here. Therefore, the Midrashim are perfect. Kalev and Yoshua didn't need the chizik. Moshe Rabbeinu made it dependent for his chazak them lukach to be priority. If you need the chizik, then take the fruit. Kalev and Yoshua were convinced that God's in control. They didn't have to take the fruit. But the other ones weren't convinced. And therefore Moshe Rabbeinu's chiyuv to them of taking the fruit applied. So that's why Kalev and Yoshua forced the other ones to take the fruit, but they didn't take it themselves. Because Moshe made a contingent on his chazak them. And that was the sin they cried that night. Why'd they cry? That we can't do it. And if we can't do it, it can't be done. We're lost. That was the crying. What fixes up that crying? The crying on Tisha B'Av. How do we cry on Tisha B'Av? Ribbono Shel Olam, you promised that you're going to redeem us. We can't do it. So, obviously you're going to do it. That's a different kind of crying. There's a crying of giving up hope, of feeling abandoned. That's the crying they had that night. And the crying we cry on Tisha B'Av is not giving up hope and feeling abandoned. It's the opposite. It's the crying like a baby cries. Why does a baby cry? The baby knows something's wrong. It knows that it can't do anything about it. It can't even really understand what's wrong, conceptually. But it knows something's uncomfortable. And he knows that if he cries, a form of a human being, a big human being, is going to appear, usually in the shape of a woman, and know exactly what's wrong and take care of it. That's the crying of Tisha B'Av. Ribbono Shel Olam, you said it's going to be. We can't do it. We're crying, therefore, that you should do it for us. Which is the tikkun for Ribbono Shel Olam, you said it's going to be. We can't do it, therefore it can't be done. Two different kinds of crying. One crying is the crying of feeling hopeless, and the other is the crying of feeling like a baby, that if I cry, somebody's going to hear and something's going to be done about it. Two different kind of things, one's Mesach and the other. But that was the Chet HaMeraglim, and that's the concept of Atzas Meraglim. It does not mean that they went with a plot to come and malign Eretz Yisrael. It means that they had a bad Hashkafa, which in the end could have been corrected, but they didn't correct it, so it turned out to come to conclusions that were wicked.
Isn't there something to the, I think you once told us, just got to ruin, about the fact that because they had all the miracles and everything, and the bear and the fruit and the mon and everything, and then they weren't. And then, now we're going to Eretz Yisrael, and now we have to fend for ourselves.
That they'd rather stay in the Midbar. Right. There's an opinion like that, that the Meraglim were the Nesiim. They were the leaders.
Right.
And they were mesugal to lead in the kind of environment that existed in the desert. They weren't mesugal to lead in a different environment. And therefore, subconsciously even, they wanted to stay where they were. Right. They didn't want to lose their seats, their jobs. Right. So, Mimela, they interpreted things in a negative way, so they ended up staying in the Midbar. There is such an opinion like that, too. But what I'm saying makes them less Rishoyim, just people who had a mistaken idea that eventually they applied in a very negative way, and it came out to be very negative.
Because the idea that the light was so pure in the Midbar was so...
Right, but because of that, exactly,
they didn't want to leave that environment.
That's also true, but also they couldn't imagine, therefore, that if it wouldn't be like that, that God would still be in control. God, when God's in control, this is the way it looks. When it's natural, then we're in control. They couldn't understand that God can still be in control and can still be a gashmiistic, what's it called, natural world. That was the mistake. And we're basically in the same situation. Right? Most of us, if not all of us, right, may believe that God runs the world. But Lemaisa, right, wars are won by, you know, what's it called, superior weaponry and strategy, and Parnassah is made by people who have business acumen, and we believe that too. So there has to be some kind of happy balance between, yes, you have to make ishtavos, right? You don't go into war and with a slingshot, right? On the other hand, you believe that with all the weaponry or whatever, it's still the Rabban Shalom who either gives you the victory or doesn't give you the victory, because nothing is a guarantee. You can have all the greatest weaponry in the world. See today, the Rabban Shalom showing us. Now, you can have the best army with everything, and the situation is of such, it's of no help. The kind of enemy we have, right, because of the constraints we have, because of the nations of the world, or the perceived constraints, there's nothing we can do with our army. We have to deal with people with kid gloves. Right, you're not allowed to fight. It's like a game. Right? No, people games are playing with your existence. It's not a game. But that's the way people fight. I fight like a game. Right? So it's a very, very delicate balance between believing that the Rabbanu Shel Olam control, at the same time knowing that you have to do ishtadlis, and not confusing ishtadlis with cause and effect.